This is Focus on Our Sages with Rabbi Danny Sackstein on 101.9 High FM.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Soul to Soul. Wonderful to be with you this Wednesday afternoon. And we all have our sights on Pesach, not far to go. And I'm sure many are preparing and cleaning and cooking and getting ready for the great and holy festival that approaches us. Pesach begins on Friday night, this Friday night. And so first night Pesach is Friday night. First day Pesach is Saturday, Shabbos. Second night Pesach and the second Seder is on Saturday night, Motzei Shabbos. And Sunday, second day Pesach. And then we continue with Chol HaMoed, which are the intermediate days in between the two festivals, the two Yomim Tovim. And we then have seventh night Pesach on Thursday night, and seventh day on Friday next week. And finally, we complete Pesach with next Shabbos. Friday night is eighth night, and Saturday next week is eighth day. That's the wonderful, incredible Yom Tov of Pesach. Pesach is a time which is really has a great stronghold within the psyche of the Jewish people. We find that even when Jews are estranged and are not observant and not connected to the Torah and mitzvot, nonetheless, Pesach and Yom Kippur are the two times when Jews from all places and from all backgrounds and all levels of observance have a connection and have a feeling for those special days, for Pesach and Yom Kippur. So Pesach is a time where, please God, all of our Jewish brothers and sisters will be sitting at the Seder, will be sitting with family or friends around the table, and observing Pesach, observing the Pesach Seder. Very powerful, important time, one of the most important nights of the year within the Jewish calendar. There are important mitzvahs that we observe in the Seder. So right now we find ourselves preparing for Pesach, getting rid of the chometz, getting rid of all of the leaven products. The prohibition is very severe and very strict in the Torah that we're not allowed to own any leaven products. And of course, we're not allowed to consume any chometz of any products that have leaven in them. In other words, anything that has gone through the fermentation, when flour and water are mixed together, so automatically after 18 minutes, there's a fermentation, there's a development of what we call chametz, which is the leaven which results from flour and water. The only way to prevent that when flour and water have been mixed is to make sure the baking process is completed within those 80 minutes. So the mixing of the flour and water, the kneading of the dough, the shaping of the dough, the baking is done within 18 minutes. Those are matzahs. There's not enough time for fermentation. But anything that is not made in that strict way is chametz. It's prohibited to own such substances on Pesach. It's prohibited, of course, to consume such things on Pesach. So therefore, there's a lot of hard work and preparation in order to ensure that we are kosher on Pesach. Please stay with us. We'll continue shortly.
This is Focus on Our Sages with Rabbi Danny Sackstein on 101.9 High FM.
We're talking, of course, about Pesach and getting ready for Pesach. There's really so much to cover and so much to say. Let's try and get a general overview first to prepare ourselves, and then we can hone in on some of the smaller details. We have so as we know, the Leil HaSeder, the night of the Pesach Seder, which is Friday night and Saturday night. Here in Chutz Laaretz, out of Israel, we have the opportunity to have two Sedarim, two Pesach Seders, and there are important mitzvahs that are observed at the Seder. So before we get to the Seder, so we're talking about getting our homes ready, getting rid of the chametz, getting rid of all the leaven products, and ensuring that we are kosher at Pesach. So that requires a lot of hard work. Firstly, to get rid of all those products that have leaven in them, which is a lot, which is, you know, many, many of the everyday items that we have in our kitchens that we are consuming. So those we have to get rid of for Pesach, or we can sell them. If you in touch with any competent halachic authority, they can arrange the sale of your chometz. It's done through the U.S. You can, on their website, you can download and fill out the form and ensure that you can sell your chometz. So that's a proper, valid sale that we sell to a non-Jew, the chometz that we have. And therefore, We can put that chametz, those items in a place that are sold to the non-Jew for Pesach. If that non-Jew appears at your door because you've signed the power of attorney, he isn't able to help himself, or she's able to help herself to whatever they have bought that you have sold. So that is a valid halachic sale, that if a person wants to hold on to some of the chametz, they should make sure that they sell it. It's a transgression to own any chametz products over Pesach. Now, of course, the kitchen where we're not allowed to consume any chametz is very difficult. You're not even able to consume a crumb of chametz. So we clean out the kitchen very well, clean out the fridge, clean out the freezer. We kasher, we kosher all the other surfaces in the kitchen. We make sure it's better to have a Pesach oven because it's very difficult to kasher an oven. We can, however, kasher our stove. We kasher our sinks. If they're metal sinks, they can be kashered with boiling water. So we have to make sure our kitchens are kasher for Pesach. And then, of course, all the items that we buy for Pesach need to have the Beis Din Kasher LePesach stamp on them, sticker on them, in order to ensure that they are free of any chametz, of any concern. And in the modern world of food technology and production that we live in today, it's very difficult to assess ourselves based on the ingredients and based because there are many preservatives, there are many items that may have chametz in them as a base, which we're not aware of. Sometimes there's anti-binding agents that come from wheat starch that you might find in flour, in sugar, etc. In sugar and in salt. It's just an example. Many dried fruit often have these starch agents, which are preservatives. So one should not take chances, and all the items we purchase, unless they are raw fruits and vegetables, should have a Pesach Heksha on them in order to ensure that whatever we consume of a Pesach is kasher LePesach. So it's not just simply not eating bread. Of course, that's a very serious transgression. No Jew should consume bread over Pesach, chas v'sholom, God forbid. But even the many other products that we have need to be kasher LePesach to ensure that there's no chametz products in that which we consume. And right now, you know, many Jewish homes across the world are frantically preparing to ensure that we're ready for the holy festival, and we're observing the commandments of our Creator, of God, to ensure that through these 8 days we do not consume any chametz, and our homes are chametz free, are kasher LePesach. The Leil HaSeder, the night of Pesach, is such an important and powerful night. It brings with it such power and light within our lives, within our homes. It's something that links the generation, takes us all the way back to Mount Sinai. We all have beautiful memories of sitting around that Pesach Seder with our parents, with our grandparents, with our loved ones, some of whom are not with us anymore. Pesach connects the generations. Pesach brings us into the future. Pesach Seder is a time when we are observing a number of mitzvot. The mitzvot that we observe on Pesach is there's two Torah commandments, there are four rabbinic commandments that are being observed on Pesach. The Torah commandments are Higadata Labincha Bayomahu, you should teach your children on this day about what happened to the Jewish people in Egypt. And so we go through the story of the Haggadah, and we're very fortunate that the Haggadah is laid out for us. We don't have to look into the verses and communicate the story on our own accord. We have it right in front of us. The Haggadah tells us what we need to say, what we need to communicate. The Haggadah in the form that we have now is about 2,000 years old, attributed to Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, the great author of the Mishnah, and it very beautifully lays out the story of the Jewish people that were taken into bondage and were subjugated and oppressed by the Egyptians, and how God, through great miracles and wonders, brought the Jewish people out of Egypt and created us, his nation, the nation of Israel, the Jewish people. So we go through the Haggadah. It's important to go through Haggadah in a way that we understand, in a way that's relevant, in a way that's exciting and dynamic and engaging, not to get caught up in too many of the fine details and show how smart we are with all the fancy Divrei Torah and all the nuances that we're bringing out. It's important to remain with a pshat, with a simple, basic understanding of the Haggadah, and bring that out and communicate that to those around the table. Depending on the level of those around the table will be the focus, the tone of the Haggadah, because some are If we got children, the focus needs to be the children, and depending on the ages of their children, so that will be the level of what is communicated. But it needs to be, the Haggadah needs to be said in English, unless everybody understands Hebrew. So one should say it in English, and there's nothing wrong, and on the contrary, it's better to say it in English so people understand, it's relevant, it's got some meaning and significance, and it should be on the level that the children around the table, so if it's small children, so they're not going to understand much, but at least there should be something that they get out of it. But as the children get older, so it should be on their level and in a way that they can appreciate. And it's interestingly enough, the entire structure of the Haggadah is questions and answers. We encourage questions. Where Judaism is a religion that the more questions, the better. That we are not frightened to listen to questions. We're not frightened to deal with any questions because we have very good answers for all of those questions. And Judaism is a religion of tremendous depth based on empirical evidence and deep understanding of life and of history and of events that truly happened and of God revealing himself to the Jewish people. So we encourage questions, we answer those questions, we take them seriously, and the whole structure of the Seder is based on questions and answers. So the one Torah commandment, mitzvah d'oraisa, that we fulfill, all of us fulfill on the night of Pesach, which is with the Tusaron, which is on Friday night and on Saturday night, is communicating to our children, v'yigadet l'bincha, the story of the Jewish people of the coming out of Egypt. So that's the one mitzvah. The second Torah mitzvah that we observe in Pesach is the eating of the matzah. The eating of matzah is a Torah d'oraisa, is a mitzvah d'oraisa, is a commandment from the Torah. And we all need to at least have a kazayis of matzah. A kazayis of matzah, which is 28 grams of matzah, is a minimum we all should be having, which is about a half a piece of machine matzah. And everybody needs to ensure, all of us, every single Jew needs to have a half a piece of matzah while reclining on Pesach night. And that's a very powerful Torah mitzvah. The Kabbalists and Mekubalim tell us that by having the matzah, we are building emunah. It's like when somebody goes to the doctor and he prescribes a medicine. So we don't know what that medicine is doing and how it all works. The doctors and the chemists perhaps know. But we take the pill and it does its thing. It does the job. On Pesach, when we have matzah, so does the job of building our emunah. It's a pull that builds our emunah. We will discuss that a little bit further in a moment. So this second Torah mitzvah is the matzah. Everybody should relate the story in English. You can do it quickly. In English, shouldn't take too long. And we also have the matzah, which is a Torah commandment. There are also four mitzvahs derabbanan, rabbinic mitzvahs of the Seder. They are the arba kosos, the four cups of wine. One could have grape juice, preferable to have a little bit of a taste of alcohol. So it's either wine or grape juice for the four cups. Kiddush being the first one. One should have at least 86 milliliters, a reviz of grape juice of wine to fulfill the mitzvah, while reclining. So that, the one mitzvah is the rabbinic mitzvah is four cups of wine. The second rabbinic mitzvah is to recline while we're having the four cups of wine. The third rabbinic mitzvah is to have maror. We have maror on Pesach, as we know. The best thing to have maror, says the Gemara, is our lettuce, is our romaine lettuce, because it symbolizes the experience of the Jewish people in Mitzrayim. The longer it stays in the ground, the more bitter it gets. That's how it was for the Jewish people. The longer we were there, the more bitter our time, our experience in Mitzrayim became. And that, unfortunately, is the prototype of the experience of Jews in every community we find ourselves in the diaspora. The longer we're there, the more bitter it becomes. Unfortunately, there are few exceptions to the experience of the Jewish people around the globe in this exile of the last 2,000 years. So that's the third mitzvah d'rabbanan, is the maror, is the bitter herbs. And the fourth one is halal, that we're supposed to say halal and praise God on the night of Pesach, which is a very powerful experience. We're supposed to say it's halal seriously, thank God for those miracles, appreciate God creating the nation of Israel, bringing us out and giving us the Torah, because the being in Mitzrayim, the experience of being in Egypt, was a necessary prerequisite in order to receive the Torah. And through those miracles, we came out and we ended up at Mount Sinai, and the Jewish people were born. That is something that we all should be really grateful for, to appreciate the incredible gift that God gave us, the Torah, and the great privilege of being part of Klal Yisrael, of the Jewish people, with a unique and special mission to fulfill in God's world. Pesach brings us back to our beginnings, to our birth, and to the start of the Jewish people. So those are the mitzvahs of Leil HaSeder. Let's now look a little bit about understanding what Pesach really is. We've just been through Shabbos. The Shabbos before Pesach is called Shabbos HaGadol. There are a few reasons that are given for that, Shabbos HaGadol, the great Shabbos. One of them is that on the 10th of Nisan, God commanded the Jewish people to take a lamb and to designate it in order to use it for the Korban Pesach, for this Pesach offering. And the lamb was a deity, was worshipped in Egypt. The Jewish people followed God's commandment at great fear and peril, because the Egyptians wouldn't take a liking to these slaves now taking what was their deity and putting it aside to slaughter it. But not one Jew was harmed, and that was a great miracle. So we remember that miracle, the Shabbos before, because first Shabbos who came out of Mitzrayim, was the 10th of Nisan. We were commanded to do it on the 10th of Nisan. First, when we came to Mitzrayim was a Thursday, so Shabbos was the 10th of Nisan. So every Shabbos before, we remember that miracle. That's one reason why it's called Shabbos HaGadol. Another reason is the Haftarah that we read comes from the great prophet Malachi. Talks about the ultimate redemption, Hayom HaGadol VaHanoira, the great and awesome day when Mashiach will come and the redemption of the Jewish people will take place. And we read that Haftarah, the Shabbos for Pesach, it's called Hayom HaGadol VaHanoira. That's what Shabbos HaGadol. But there's another beautiful reason which really gives us a feeling, an understanding, a clarity as to what Pesach is. And that is that, it's called Shabbos HaGadol simply because it is the Shabbos before Pesach. The greatness that runs, that flows through the veins of all great people comes from a sense of worth and of understanding of our uniqueness and our mission. Every person that has greatness in them has a sense of their position, of their potential, of their mission in the world. And nothing gives us a greater understanding of our mission as a people than Pesach. Pesach defines for us who we are, where we came from, and of course when we know where we came from, we know where we're going. Pesach is about the incredible miracles that God brought to the Jew, on behalf of the Jewish people in Egypt. And Pesach leads the way to, it really provides the foundation for the life of a Jew and for the understanding and identity of a Jew. In 1936, there was an interesting commission called the Peel Commission, which was set up by the British government in order to advise them what to do with the problems they were facing in Palestine. Palestine was chaotic. They took over the British mandate after World War II, and there were different sides and different factions, and they were not able to control the situation. And so they decided to send up this commission, which would recommend to the government how, where to go from here, what the next step would be in order to gain some sort of control. And part of the Peel Commission was to interview leaders and significant figures of the time. And of course, they interviewed the great leader of the Zionist movement, David Ben-Gurion. Ben-Gurion wasn't an observant man, but listen to what he said to the Peel Commission. He turned to the British members of the commission, and he said to them, "How many British children can tell me about the beginnings of your people?" And he turned to the Americans on the panel, and he said to them, "How many Americans can tell me about that great voyage of the Mayflower 3 centuries ago that landed on Plymouth Rock? How many children can tell me who the leader of that voyage was and what food they ate and how many people there were and what day it was?" He said, "Go to any Jewish child and any Jewish child will tell you that the Jewish people came out of Egypt 3,000 years ago, more than 3,000 years ago, under the leadership of Moses, of Moshe Rabbeinu, that the day they came out was on a Thursday. They ate matzah, and there were 600,000 males over the age of 20, which means there were more than 2 million people. Any Jewish child will be able to tell you that." He says, that is who the Jewish people are. That is our uniqueness, and we need to return home to our land. That's what Ben-Gurion told the Peel Commission. And apparently his statement was very powerful, had a deep effect on them, and the Peel Commission did recommend that there should be a partition of Palestine, And that is the Jewish people. That is Pesach, because Pesach instills within all of us, instills within in ourselves and within our children, that knowledge of who we are, that knowledge of where we came from, that knowledge of what the destiny and what the mission of the Jewish people is. So we all have a great opportunity on Friday night and on Saturday night. Let's not squander that opportunity. Let's use it properly. Let's take it seriously, and let's share with our children and share with ourselves a knowledge and instill within all of us bucket loads of Jewish pride and the knowledge of who we are and what our mission is as a people in God's world. We'll continue in a moment. Please stay with us.
This is Focus on Our Sages with Rabbi Danny Sackstein on 101.9 High FM.
So we're talking about our preparations for the great and holy day of Pesach. Now, I thought I would share with you, since this is a show that deals with our sages and deals with the history, adventures in Jewish history. So let's look back into Pesach in the previous generations of the Jewish people. Pesach obviously has always been a highlight of the year, as I mentioned, probably the most important night of the year for the Jewish people. And always has been a centerpiece to our calendar for the Jewish people. Now, Pesach was when we had a temple. Let's go back to the last times when the temple was operating and functioning. We know that the leader of the Jewish people at the time was Herod. Herod was he's an Idumean. It's a long story who he was, where he came from, but he was well connected with the Romans. The Romans, after they conquered the land of Israel in their great empire, appointed Herod to run, to be the leader of the Jewish people in Rome. He was resented by the Chachamim, by the sages. He was somebody who had a megalomaniac, Herod. He was power crazy to the extent that he even murdered his wife and his own children. But Herod at one stage in his political career wanted to gain favor from the people. And he knew the best way to gain favor would be to improve the temple, to renovate the temple. And Herod was, amongst other things, a great builder. He was an incredible builder. There were a few building projects that he set his eyes towards, and he created fantastic buildings that still to this day, are standing. For example, Marat HaMachpelah, the cave of the patriarchs in Hebron, that large building that is standing over there was built by Herod. We have Herodian, which was a great palace that he built, which is just outside Jerusalem. On Masada, he had a palace that was built there. And of course, he embarked on the biggest project of all, and that was the renovation of the temple, of the second temple of Baal Sheni. Second temple before Herod was not a very impressive building. After Herod, the Gemara says, was the most impressive building in the world, that people flocked from all over the globe just to come and see the temple. It was massive. It was grand. He imported Carrara marble from Italy. The marble on the floor of the temple looked like the waves of the sea. He spared no expense and built a magnificent edifice, which was by Shani's second temple. In fact, if one goes to Jerusalem today and you walk up the steps of the southern wall, the wall of the south, the southern wall, so this it's called the Southern Excavations. They've excavated and been able to reveal the actual steps that existed up to the temple from the southern wall, which is amazing. The western wall, which is the holiest place for Jews, there's a midrash that says that God's presence will never leave the western wall. So any Jew that visits Israel should visit the western wall, and one feels a tremendous spiritual power and energy when one is there. One feels the power, the spiritual power of what the Beis HaMikdash for the temple was. But the western wall has eroded with time and with through the elements. The southern wall, which was buried under the dirt, under the soil, was very well preserved. So the steps, the actual steps that our ancestors, that our great grandparents stepped on, going towards the temple, when they went to Jerusalem for the Shalosh Regalim, for Pesach, Shavuos, and Sukkos, so the steps that they stood on are still there. You can stand on those very steps. You can see the banisters that they held onto. You can see the gates that those steps led up to. Those gates have been closed up, have been bricked up by the Arabs, as the back of their Al-Aqsa Mosque. But you can still see, like the Gemara says, the gates of Khulda, they were called, that were the gates from the south. And because Khulda Hanaviyah, the great prophetess Khulda, was buried just outside the southern wall. So they still could be seen. Now, I want to share with you an amazing, fascinating thing, which is the recollection of Pesach by Josephus. Josephus was a Jew who, he was a great historian, and he wrote down, the events and life as it was at that time. At the time, he records the Korban Pesach in the year 64 of the Common Era. Remember, the temple was destroyed in the year 70. The great Roman revolt took place in the year 66. So it was just before the revolt, and just before, it was the second last year that the temple functioned in peace in a normal and regular way. Josephus writes that, the amount of sheep that were brought for the Korban Pesach, for the Pesach offering in that year of 64 of the Common Era was 255,600 sheep. That's the amount that were brought. Now, isn't that unbelievable? Now, we know that there's an obligation for everybody to bring their own Korban Pesach. In other words, we're supposed to eat the meat of the Korban Pesach at the Pesach Seder. So we're going to see on Friday night, there'll be a part where we'll see that Pesach Matzah Maror, the Rabban Gamliel says, these three things are essential for the Seder. The Pesach is eating the meat from Korban Pesach. We have the Afikoman at the end, which is the, which reminds us of the meat that they ate, the roasted meat, the roasted lamb they ate for the Korban Pesach. Now, everybody was, that was one of the highlights of the year, to bring the Korban Pesach. It was a very important, part of a person's spiritual journey and spiritual growth. And, everybody would have to have some meat from the Korban Pesach. Now, one sheep, one lamb would be enough. Sometimes 20 people would join together with one lamb. But so Josephus writes that there were never more than 20 people per lamb, but at least the minimum was 10 people per lamb. So if there were 255,600 that were brought, it means that represent 10 people then would take from that meat and would braai it on Erev Pesach, on the afternoon of the 14th of Nisan, and then they would eat it on at the Pesach Seder, on the night of the 15th of Nisan. So it means that there were more than 2.5 million people that year in Yerushalayim. Isn't that unbelievable? And he writes how the heels were white from the sheep that were brought in. And now there's another source I want to share with you. And that was the source by the name, there was a certain person who was actually the Roman consul in Jerusalem, and he wrote a report back to Rome about what happened in Jerusalem on Pesach. His was from the year before, from the year 60, because we know he was there 62 and 63 of the Common Era, this particular Roman consul, and his name was Marcus, and Marcus writes about what he saw in Jerusalem that year, 63 of the Common Era, on Pesach. So he also writes that there were millions of people that came into Jerusalem. And he said that because there was not enough hotels, rooms and inns to absorb the massive influx of people, so people stayed on the hills. So the hills around Jerusalem, they were tented, people were in tents, and he said wherever you turned, you saw tented people on those hills. And he describes how, just like in the Mishnah and Pesachim says, that there were three groups that came in on Erev Pesach, and they divided into three groups on the 14th of Nisan to bring the Korban Pesach, and it describes how the Kohanim would stand in a line, and each one would pass the, what would be is that after the lamb was slaughtered, the blood was gathered in a bowl, and that bowl then was taken to the Mizbeach, to the altar, and sprinkled. So the gathering of the blood is called the Kabbalah of the dam, and then it's the Zrika, the sprinkling on the Mizbeach, which is the end of the process. And if that bowl was dropped, so it would invalidate the whole process, they would have to, that group of people would have to slaughter a different lamb in order for it to be valid. So it was very important the Kohanim wouldn't drop it. And Marcus describes how there was like a long conveyor belt of Kohanim, and each one was passing the bowl one to the other until it got to the Mizbeach and it was sprinkled in the Mizbeach. And then the empty bowls were passed back also on the conveyor belt. He describes how the Kohanim would train 90 days in order to get this right, in order that it would be an efficient process, so it wouldn't be too onerous for people to have to wait a long time for this to happen. And so they could get through all the people, so it would be efficient and it would be fast. He writes that Then they would take that meat and they would braai it. They would roast it. The Korban Pesach had to be roasted. So you would just see fires on all the hills around Yerushalayim. And these 2.5 million people would be roasting the Korban Pesach. He said the minag, the custom in Jerusalem on the night of Pesach was nobody locked their doors. That every door was open. People would come into their living room and find people sleeping there. That such was the custom for the Jewish people on Pesach. So we get a kind of sense as to what Pesach was. And we should try and feel, one goes to Eretz Yisrael today, you feel Aliyas Rechel, thousands of people go to Eretz Yisrael for Pesach. It's a very powerful experience. People go for Birkas Kohanim during Chol HaMoed. One gets a sense of Aliyas Rechel, of Jewish people going up to the temple on Pesach. But we should realize what it was within the Jewish people and try and connect to that in some way. The Korban Pesach actually continued even after the Temple was destroyed. So we know in the year 66 the revolt began, and it's actually written by the Roman historians that even the armies of Vespasian and Titus, there was a truce, there was a great war and rebellion against Rome, there was a truce on Pesach, so the people could still come and bring their Korban Pesach during Pesach. And even after the Temple was destroyed in 70 of the Common Era, was destroyed by the Romans. And in fact, we see interestingly enough that the same day that Pesach falls is also the day of is the same day of Tisha B'Av. So for example, this year, Pesach's Friday night, Saturday. Tisha B'Av will be Friday night, Saturday. Because you can't fast on Shabbos, the fast will then be Saturday night, Sunday, on the 10th of Av. So the maror we have in Pesach is also the maror from Tisha B'Av, removing the destruction of the temple. But they continue to bring the Korban Pesach, even after the temple was destroyed. The Chasam Sofer has got a very interesting tshuva. He wrote in the 1930s, he writes that as long as you know where the place of the Mizbeach was, you can still bring the Korban Pesach. You don't need a temple to bring the Korban Pesach, Pesach offering. And so for about a century after the temple was destroyed in the year 70, they continued to bring the Korban Pesach. In fact, Rabbi Goren, after 1967, he's the chief rabbi of Tzahal, wanted to reinstitute the Korban Pesach to find the place of the Mizbeach. But obviously he was not successful, mainly for political reasons. We see the WAP would not have been happy with that. It would have caused a great outcry. So nonetheless, that is the halacha. But it's important for us to sense what Pesach is for the Jewish people and to try and tap into that, this Pesach ourselves. Please stay with us. We'll be back in a moment.
This is Focus on Our Sages with Rabbi Danny Sackstein on 101.9 Chai FM.
One of our great sages was the Maharal of Prague. The Maharal lived in the 16th century, was a person of tremendous genius, and we have discussed him many times in this program. In fact, my wife is a direct descendant of the Maharal. The Maharal writes that the Chag of Pesach is the Chag of strengthening our emunah, of our faith in Hashem. And he says that all that we are doing on the Pesach Seder is to strengthen our emunah, to strengthen our connection to Hashem. So we should use this great time to strengthen our belief and our faith and our trust in God and our understanding of what the beginnings, what the foundation of our religion, of our belief system is. In Mitzrayim, in Egypt, they were koifrim, which means the Egypt denied the existence of God. Our job on Pesach, what happened in Egypt, the Jewish people coming out, was to counter that kfira, to counter and undo the non-believing Egyptians. So, and what were the Kli Yakka says an amazing thing. He says that another one of our great sages, the Kli Yakka, writes, he says that there were three fundamental things that Pharaoh denied. In other words, Pharaoh said, who is God? Moses went to Pharaoh and said, we want to go out and serve our God. Who is this God that you want to serve, says Pharaoh. So the Kli Yakka writes, and he says that there were three fundamental things that Pharaoh and the Egyptians do not believe in. Firstly, they didn't believe in the existence of God, that there's a creator. Second, they didn't believe that there's something called Hashkacha Pratis, which means that God has a interest in the individual personal needs of a human being. And thirdly, that God controls the entire world. Those were the three major elements of the kfira, of the denial of Pharaoh and of the Egyptians. And the purpose of the plagues was to show that all of these views are absolutely wrong, was to contradict and disprove these three things, these three beliefs that the Egyptians and Pharaoh had. And that's why the Kli Yakka explains that there were three sections of the plagues. It's very interesting, three different It's divided up into three different distinct parts, the plagues. There's, we run out of time, unfortunately, so we can't go in the detail of it. But the first three plagues are Dam Tzvardea Kinim, that spells Datzach. And the second three plagues are Arov Dever Shchin, which spells Adash. And the last four are Barad Arab Echoshech Machos Bechoritz, which spells Ba'achav. So those, the Kliyaka says the three, the Rebbe, Rabbi Yehuda said that we divide the plagues into those three parts because those three parts came to undermine and contradict those three beliefs of Pharaoh. And that's why the Kliyaka goes into Psukim and says that after each of these three plagues, it says, in order that you will know that I am Hashem. L'man yedu ki ani Hashem. So the first three came to prove the fundamental belief that, God controls the entire world. In other words, that there is a God. Right? Those are the first three, that God does exist, which is Datzach, and the second three, which is Adash. It came to show that everything that, that there is such a concept called Hashgacha Pratis. That is, there's such a concept called, divine providence, where God actually, cares about individuals. So I don't have time to show you why those particular plays communicated those messages. And the third one is that God controls everything in the world. God controls everything in the heavens, in the skies, the darkness, the locusts, and of course, Marcus Bechoris, the death of the firstborn. So we see that with those three parts of the plagues, very powerfully it's communicated to the Egyptians, those three messages, that there is a God, that God cares about individuals, Hashkocha Pratis, because God distinguished between the Jews and the Egyptians, and thirdly, that God controls the entire world. So that's the job in Pesach. On Pesach, we are, and we go through the 10 plagues, that's what we're trying to bring out and communicate to ourselves and to our children, is that we have a creator who created the world, that God cares about all of us. God cares about the small choices that we make, the strength of character that we have, the morality that we live with, the striving to reach greater spiritual heights and overcome our lower physical self. That is, God cares greatly about those choices we're making. And finally, God is omnipotent. God controls the world. God controls the entire universe. So that's our job on Pesach, is to reiterate that in our hearts and in our homes and communicate that to our children and strengthen our emunah, because the night of Pesach, it brings the light of emunah for the entire year for ourselves and for our families. Wishing everybody a Chag Kashav Sameach. Thank you for listening and have a wonderful day.